Are you snapping your fingers, Michelle?
Kind of, yeah.
Those are finger snaps in there, if you can't tell.
That's pretty cool.
So, Michelle, that music is different from the normal music of our Better Call Saul intro. It's a song from YouTube. It's a song from the 90s. But it's our chance to introduce our idea that we wanted to do a while back to comment on YouTube videos.
Right.
And yes. A good time to do that is at the end of one podcast, because we have nothing to do after this is over until our next podcast start. So we'll do a little sample of this song at the end of this podcast if you want to listen to it.
I think that's great. I think that'll be fun. I hope we have some good commentary on it. I think we might.
So, Michelle, if you could care less about that and just want to talk about Better Call Saul, Better Call Saul's final episode of season 4 aired, and it was Winter. We're a little late because of our schedules again, but what did you think of episode 10, Winter?
I'm really conflicted with this. Now, this week, every other week that we've watched this, I have read reviews on it before we podcast. But this week, I didn't want to do that. I really wanted to kind of flesh it out myself, and particularly when I found out we weren't going to be doing it soon after, like the next, like 12 hours after it aired. I just wanted to really see how I felt about it. So I'm really conflicted because I love the way they tell a story. I think they could tell you how paint dries and just make it so interesting. Everything about their storytelling ability, their writing, their cinematography, everything about everything is so compelling to me. But I hate the story. I hate this. And I don't know what I was expecting. It goes right along with everything that we should know about it. And, I mean, they set us up. They, you know, it was the perfect tee up, the perfect, you know, hit. And, I mean, that's exactly what we knew was going to happen in a way. But I don't like it. I'm really bothered by it. How did you feel?
Well, I thought this was an okay episode. It wasn't really a breathtaking season-ending episode, though. You say, wow, this is so good, I can't wait. Even though I kind of can't wait for season 5.
Right.
But it's, I don't know, I think maybe we're getting a second-team quarterback situation here, too. Because Vince Gilligan isn't really running the show anymore. He's kind of on other projects. And Peter Gould and his team are running it. And I don't know, some stuff didn't kind of add up. There were seemingly almost some mistakes in this episode. Plot threads that didn't connect together.
Okay. Yeah. Now, that's funny. Mike, my husband Mike, said the same thing.
Well,
he was confused by it. That's right. Yeah. So it's confusing to Mike's. No, but he said the same thing. I didn't really get that so much. But it'll be interesting to see where your kind of disconnect is and see if it lined up with his. That's funny.
I also think we're going to be kind of hard on this series because they're turning our beloved Jimmy into Saul. And we're losing our Jimmy. And that's kind of a sad thing.
That's what I was saying. And, I mean, we knew it was coming. And all the people, everybody's been screaming, you know, it's Better Call Saul. Better Call Saul. Where's Saul? Where's Saul? And I've enjoyed Jimmy. Now, I mean, you know, the whole of Saul that we saw in Breaking Bad, we've got so much more Jimmy now that Jimmy is the character that I don't want to lose.
Yeah.
So I don't like it.
I know we don't want to lose him, even though that's illogical, because we know what he becomes.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. And the story is told really, really well. And we got all the Mike background or some more Mike background. They definitely, you know, dribble that out to us in small little amounts. But I just don't like it. I don't like what happened to Mike. Of course, I don't like what happened to Ziegler. I don't like Gus. I don't like anybody. I don't like Kim a whole lot. I don't like Jimmy becoming Saul. I don't know. I'm conflicted.
I still like Mike. I mean, Mike's pretty true. There was an odd synchronicity to this too, Michelle, because we decided, you know, I thought it'd be good to introduce this whole YouTube thing that we're going to try with
right.
The ending of this series, and just be good to let people hear it a little bit, because they kind of have to hear that we're doing it if we inject it into this episode.
Right.
But the YouTube thing we're going to do has a bit of a karaoke heroism thing to it. And this episode had a karaoke hero in it when I didn't even know that at the time that, you know, there was going to be a karaoke set piece in this episode.
Well, yeah, you couldn't have known.
So that was kind of funny. I read some of the comments too, cause we had this a little bit of extra time this week, and a lot of people are comparing, Werner to Walter White through the whole, cause it's Werner Heisenberg was the guy that Heisenberg is named after, that Walter's named after, his name was Werner Heisenberg.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some comparisons on Reddit and everywhere to Werner and Walter White. And maybe the most direct one is him being I think Hank called him the dumbest, you're the dumbest smart guy I know, or the smartest dumb guy I know.
Yeah.
And that essentially is what turned out to be Werner. He was a super smart engineering, structural engineering or demolition engineer, whatever he is. But he was really stupid in this episode, in this ending of the series.
Yeah, that story I didn't buy totally, if you want to know the truth. I just don't think it was very realistic. He can't be that smart and know how the means that they're going to use to keep him from knowing the outside of the building, the means they're going to, I mean, just how careful they were, and then think it's going to be okay. I thought my friend Michael was going to be upset with me and very, very mad, but then he would get over it because he knew that my heart, whatever. I mean, I don't believe that. And he had to have known who he's working for. He keeps acting like he's working for Mike, and I think Mike's made it uber clear ever since he's known him that that's not who he's working for. I don't know.
I guess apparently intelligence and naivety, what's that word? Being naive, are different branches on the tree. Because I think Werner is super smart, and in the story they made it pretty clear that he really believed he could take a couple days off and run off to see his wife, and just he wasn't running away. I was wrong about that. He was running away for a weekend. He was going to come back and happily jump back in Monday morning, all bright eyed and bushy tailed.
Yeah, but he couldn't know where he was. That was the thing. That was the thing that was keeping these guys alive.
I'm not going to argue with you there. That's what's his being naive. What is that damn word?
Naivete.
Naivete. His naivete was separate from his intelligence because he wasn't stupid.
Well, that was stupid. That was just so stupid. If you would think about something like that for 10 seconds, you would realize you cannot see the outside of that place.
I know.
If he sees the outside, it's death for him.
Yep. So is that a writer's mistake, or is that just a thing we're supposed to buy in that the fact of being naive and being intelligent can both go hand in hand?
Yeah, I don't know. I just can't imagine somebody. I mean, if he had done it like the first month he was there or something, maybe, or if they hadn't went to such great lengths to keep him blindfolded on the trip there, and I mean even had so far as to have him flying into Denver. I mean, the guy knew he was in New Mexico. He's talking about it, and it's just like, I mean, he can't know that. He can't know anything. So
well, he's talking on the phone too,
right?
You know, they let him talk on the phone, and then Mike lets him talk on the phone one final time to his wife, and he could have said, you know, help. Could have just, like, blown the whole cover of everything.
Yeah, but Mike pretty much told him that if he did that, that she would be killed too.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, that's all. That's what I thought about it. I mean, it's still, like you say, it's fun to watch no matter what these guys produce and film and present to us. It's fun to watch no matter how the plot seems to have a couple loose ends, so I still enjoyed it.
Oh yeah, it's still just like quality TV any way you slice it. I think it's like great TV, but I'm a little disappointed in the content, even though I knew it was going there. I'm a little disappointed in that, and I guess there is a couple things, you know, like I was saying about Ziegler being crazy. I mean, that's just like, that's not okay for him to be like that. And that could have been, I don't know. That wasn't my favorite, but there was other things too. Like, okay, what did you think about how we first started out? You were talking about the karaoke. I mean, Chuck is standing up for Jimmy, and they never showed us anything like that. We haven't seen anything where Chuck was on Jimmy's side the way they showed this, I don't think. He's the one who stood up for him at the beginning to when he got his license.
Yeah, I think that was I have to do, there's no way I'm bowing out of this. Because Chuck fought against Jimmy being a lawyer the whole time. He didn't want him to tarnish the law.
Right.
You know, the law profession by letting his brother into it. So I think this was just one thing that, like, you kind of have to do it. The most important legal person in your life, and he happens to be your brother. How could he have anyone else do that?
Yeah, but then he goes to the karaoke bar, like you brought up, afterward, and Jimmy... okay, first of all, I don't sing karaoke for a reason, because, you know, I'm no good. And this was some bad karaoke. This was rough.
Until Chuck, you and got Ernie both.
Yeah, me and Ernie and Jimmy. Jimmy was bad, too. And Jimmy can actually sing, can he? I think I've heard him sing on something before.
I don't think so. He says he said in the Insider podcast he can't sing.
Oh, okay. I thought he could. I think I don't know why I'm thinking that. But
I mean,
anyway.
Michael McKean is an accomplished musician. He was like in Spinal Tap, and I think he's actually won a Grammy. He's a musician, okay. And a
sure.
Vocalist, so he can sing and play. I think he plays guitar. But yeah, he was in Spinal Tap and, you know, as a rock star. So it was very clear the difference between the good voice and the poor voice of the people at the karaoke bar. Do you like the idea of the karaoke hero though, Michelle? Like, if you ever watch karaoke in person or on YouTube, you really root for the common man to pull off the karaoke feat.
Well, sure.
When
yeah.
they do, it's a moment of like temporary stardom.
It is, and it's a moment that everybody rallies.
Yeah, they rally for you. That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, so Jimmy's up there singing, but Chuck comes up and joins him. And Chuck was going to leave, and Kim's unsurprised because that's... Okay, and I didn't know they knew Ernie from so long ago. I thought Ernie was like a newer guy. I don't know why I thought that. But, well, yeah, I kind of do know why I thought that, because Ernie was still like Chuck's flunky. And this is years after Jimmy's become an attorney. So that was kind of odd to me, right?
Yeah, I didn't make that connection or catch that misconnection. But yeah, that's a good point. This is still 4 years away from the real Saul Goodman. So, I mean, who knows how soon Jimmy started practicing law and how soon his whole involvement with Ernie. I guess, I don't know, maybe Ernie was there the whole time. I guess he has to be if that's what they're telling us.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're showing him there, and this was, you know, and so they show him there way back when, because Jimmy had been a lawyer for several years, so Ernie was there then, and even back up until the time like last year when Chuck died, Ernie was his flunky, and I didn't even know. I mean, I even thought maybe at one point he was a paralegal at that point and wasn't even an attorney yet. And maybe he was. I don't know. I guess I should have looked it up before I started talking about it.
Well, some people probably work for law firms and never become more than mail clerks and stuff. You know, they don't all move up to be attorneys.
Sure.
Ernie might have worked there 6 years, you know.
That's a good point. Maybe he was a paralegal the whole time or something. That's
or
a
less.
Good point. Yeah.
A mail clerk, you know, whatever.
So gopher. What did you think about them singing Winner Takes It All?
I don't like that ABBA song. I like some ABBA songs, so I don't like that one. Did you like it?
Well, I mean, yes, I do like it, but it just went along with like the theme of the show. Okay, the show is Winner. Who is the winner in this? Who won? You know, and it was just really cool how they were singing that. And then a little bit later on, we see the kids going before, trying to get the scholarship before the Chuck you know, Memorial Scholarship or whatever, and there's winners there, but I mean, and then at the end, you know, Jimmy wins, spoiler alert, but does he? I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe they're just introducing the philosophy that if you think, like Jimmy does, that the winner takes it all, that you have to do whatever you need to do to be the winner, that you'll do unscrupulous things. Like coming in second or third isn't just okay, that you have to vanquish and be the winner.
Right.
And even if it's getting even later and losing now, getting even later and winning over, you know, later, then that's kind of Jimmy's MO now.
Yes, it is. And it's like that's all that's important is winning to him. Kind of. That's kind of how I saw it. Especially when he's talking to the girl that didn't get the scholarship. He's just talking about, and I don't want to get too far ahead, but it just seems like everything he's saying is that winning is the most important thing to him.
Yeah, talking to that girl was a pretty cool scene because it's almost like, what would you say to the young Michelle from Tennessee if you could talk to her when she was 15? You know, that was kind of him talking to himself, talking to her like that.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so then they go home and Jimmy is drunk, and they go into this dismal apartment, but Chuck is being good to him. He's taking his shoes off, and he's getting him in bed and bringing him a puke bucket and bringing him water and all that kind of stuff. And then Chuck, I mean, he's being very fatherly. I made a note. I called him fatherly. But then he says he's going to leave, and then he looks at the time, and he realizes that he has to be somewhere the next morning. He said earlier, and he looks at the time, and he's, you know, realizes he doesn't have time to leave. There's no point. So he climbs in bed beside Jimmy, and they continue to sing their Winner Takes It All. So, I don't know. That was... I have never pictured Chuck and Jimmy having that kind of relationship.
I think it's a gray area that makes this a smart show, though, because it's never like, oh, that's how it is. It's this... it's black and that, oh no, that's how it is. That other part's white. It's, there's always the gray complication, the complicated parts that are unpinable down. And that's the trickiness between Jimmy and Chuck, you know, Jimmy, yeah. Jimmy went day after day by shopping for him every morning with ice and, you know, crappy non-electrical stuff and all that. That was a pain in the ass. And he stood up for Chuck to Howard and the law firm and all that.
Yeah.
And then he screws him in court and the insurance and all that. It's just gray.
It is. Yeah, that's a good point to bring all that up because Jimmy was good to him. I just don't think they've ever shown us Chuck being good to Jimmy or taking up for Jimmy. So I was a little surprised that they showed us this in the finale.
I don't mind this so much as some other stuff that they do that appears gray that we'll get to probably in the next scene or two, that especially yeah. with Kim, that bothers me a lot.
Well, I didn't mind it. I just kind of wondered why they only touched on it here. And it makes me wonder if we're going to see more flashbacks in Chuck later on. But that's just something I thought that they could probably work with. I don't know if they will.
I doubt it. I don't know why. I don't know what else we would need to learn from them.
Well, when did Chuck turn against Jimmy? At what point? Because there, I mean, yeah, he's obviously, and Jimmy tells his story. He didn't think Jimmy was good enough to be an attorney. You know, he's not, the law is above Jimmy and all that. But they've only shown him be ugly to Jimmy. And that there, they took us back to the time that he wasn't. And so you can kind of understand more of Jimmy's devotion to him.
Well,
maybe.
He read to him in the tent. I mean, do you think reading the book to him in the tent and kind of scaring him, do you think that was just being kind of manipulative to Jimmy
No.
or just being kind to him?
No, I think that was being kind. I think that had meaning to Chuck, and I don't think he did it to be mean. So, yeah, that's a good point, but that's kind of making my point because all the way back when they were little, maybe he was good to him, and maybe he was good to him up until a certain point, but at what point was he not?
Well, does it matter so much when as simply that he did that they did turn. I mean, they turned different directions. They turned different paths.
The only thing that matters is I kind of wonder how long, how long did Jimmy hold on to that Chuck that he knew, doing all the stuff he did for him? Like, if Chuck had been, you know, against Jimmy for 6 months or 2 years, that's one thing. And Jimmy's still holding out for the Chuck that he always knew. But if Chuck had been against Jimmy for 12 years and had just been constant negativity, and I don't think it was that long. I think it was like 8 or something, right? That's how long he was an attorney. I don't even know why I said that. That's just what I'm thinking. I don't know how long.
I don't think he ever gave it. I don't think there was ever a binary I stopped caring point. I think he still loves Chuck. He breaks down in his car later. I don't think it's that clear. That's what makes it interesting.
Okay. I've got a different take on that breakdown, but yeah. Okay. So we go to the intro and we come back and we see that Mike's getting the guys ready to go after Ziegler. He's sending them all in different directions. This has just got to happen. The crew, we find out, is on lockdown. We find out that Ziegler does not have his passport. And Mike finds out about that place called Travel Wire that's where Marguerite has sent Ziegler money, wired it to him, and he calls them and finds out that it was wired to the Albuquerque branch. So
yeah, another kind of shabby thread, because how does Werner communicate all this to Marguerite on the phone without them knowing it? They listen to everything he says on the phone.
Right. What kind of
code?
Secret code would they have?
They can't, obviously.
Right.
Them not knowing about this plan of Werner's until he's gone is shaky.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'll definitely. Well, I mean, they might not. I mean, he could have just left. But then for them to find clues like this that they didn't see is kind of hard to swallow. Okay, then we go back to Jimmy pretending to be sad at Chuck's grave. And he has people that Chuck has had dealings with show up and see him there and bring flowers. Kim's in the car with coffee and bear claws. And that is like the whole thing is just this setup so people can see him at Chuck's grave. And it's just so like cold. It's so calculated.
I think this is Kim's plan. I don't think this is Jimmy's plan. I think she's not only just complicit in helping him do it, I think she thought of it.
I don't disagree. Yeah, I think Kim came up with this too. And they're just, you know, they're just working this plan. He mentions that Howard's the one who picked the headstone and it's big but tasteful. He's happy with that. And Jimmy feels like he's putting on a pretty good show to everybody. So.
Yeah, it's clear that it's a scam.
Yes, very, very clear. So then Lalo is looking at Los Pollos Hermanos through binoculars and taking notes of people getting into the black cars and driving off. So he knows something's going on. We have that scene. And then Mike goes into that Travel Wire place looking for Ziegler. And poor Jeff, he didn't stand a chance.
Fred.
Why'd I call him Jeff? Yeah, okay, yeah. Fred did not stand a chance once Mike came in there. It was just like all over for him. He hems and haws, and he can't give him the information. And Mike, in place of strong-arming him, gives him a sob story that his brother-in-law has dementia, and he's insulin-dependent diabetic, and he doesn't have his insulin. And basically, the guy's going to die, Fred, if you don't give me information. So he breaks and he tells them all about it and he lets them watch the security video. And then this is where Mike, he tries to find out how he got away from there, like what cab company or whatever. And he doesn't do that, but he sees him standing over there looking at the travel brochures. And he remembers something that they said about hot springs, what they were talking about on the phone, Ziegler and his wife. And he puts two and two together.
So this part is pretty well written, I think, because they show a pretty good connection to how Lalo follows this thread all the way through, because Lalo's watching the plant, the chicken plant. Then he sees all the guys leave, so he follows the guys, and then they go to the money place. So that's how Lalo gets to the money place and eventually Fred. So I like right. that. They didn't leave any of that unraveled.
Right, right. That's believable. It's coincidental, but it's believable. Gus is outside the Travel Wire place, and that's when Mike goes out to him, and that's like you said, we know that Lalo has followed them there.
It also solidifies some things with Mike and Gus. I mean, it proves to us why Gus trusts Mike so much, because Mike comes through for Gus, even though it's a pretty dramatically dastardly evil thing. He does what Gus needs without saying, oh, I can't do this, I like Werner too much, or he doesn't help Werner get away, or he doesn't give him a break. He does what Gus needs him to do. He's a good soldier.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you'd have to call him that. I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure what he was going to do. I mean, I thought I knew, but until the very end, I wasn't sure Mike would go through with it. I don't know why. I guess you knew he would, right?
Yeah. I mean, this whole stupid building the hole in the ground plant thing is, it's all about Mike. It's us learning Mike's path. It's not Werner and Kai and this stupid construction project. It's all about Mike and how Mike's evolved from a cop, essentially a cop, to who he is with Gus and Walt and everybody.
Well, Mike gets in the car and Gus wants the letter. And the letter has said that he's just going to go away for the weekend, for a long weekend. He'll be back. He's told the guys what to do and everything. And Mike says, as hard as this is, that he believes him, that he didn't go to the cops and he's only going to be gone for 4 days. And Gus tells Mike that Marguerite's on a flight. So he's been doing his due diligence in it too, and that she's landing in Denver in 9 hours. And Mike says that Gus men will be there and follow her, and then what? So he's going, then what, once you find him? And Gus just looks at him, and he does that a couple times in this. And Mike says that he just wants the opportunity to find him and bring him back so he can finish the job. And that's kind of how that scene ends.
Yeah, that's a half-hearted swing in Werner's favor. Like, maybe I can bring him back and we can let him finish this out. It's pretty half-hearted, though. He knows that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
This is all, I think Mike's formulating the plan to maybe save one more innocent party in saving Marguerite by separating Werner from Marguerite, at least. You know, do the right thing, fall on your sword, and let your wife live.
Yeah, I think Mike thinks it's a long shot, but he gives it all he's got anyway, even though it is.
Yeah.
So Mike's on the phone with the security guys talking about what Ziegler and his wife talked about. And this is where he sees those Natural Springs pamphlets, and he gets them and he goes out. And then we see that Lalo is watching from a distance and he's singing and whistling. Is he whistling? It sounded like the same Winner Takes It All,
but I'm sure it wasn't.
Yeah, I don't either, but that's just what it sounded like. Okay, then we go to commercial and we come back. And this is where we see Howard. We talked about it last week in the upcoming. But Howard is speaking about the Charles McGill Reading Room and talking about how the firm's had a rough year, but they're coming back now, which is kind of cool to see. I'm glad they didn't just leave that to rot, so to speak. And the filmmakers are there. It's the Saul Goodman filmmakers, and they're all talking about how James McGill paid for this himself. He wanted to do this, and they're just like kind of gossiping throughout the crowd. Schweikert's there, and they tell him that. And meanwhile, Jimmy's outside, and he's sitting out there like he's mourning, and Kim just says, well, he'd like to remain anonymous. And then she goes outside, and Jimmy is saying he cannot believe he wrote a $23,000 check for this. This is not in any way. There's nothing sincere about
it. No, it's all part of the plan.
Yeah,
well, it's kind of funny, though, the way Makeup Girl drops the rumor and they know that even the people that aren't there are going to get the news about it because all the people there are going to telephone talk it to everyone else who's not there. And eventually it's all going to get around to everybody that this is Jimmy's fronting the fees, the cost for this, and Jimmy's idea. And Jimmy's such a good guy for remembering Chuck. And so I like the little intricate parts of the plan. I just don't think, first of all, I don't think the plan will work. If they think Jimmy's insincere, I don't think this board is going to change their mind because they do these things, the gravestone weeping and the room dedication. And I don't think that's enough, Michelle, to get people to change their minds about somebody.
Well, the board that he set before is a recommendation board. And it's not the actual reinstatement board, from my understanding of it.
Yeah, I think that's another thing you were right about, and I was wrong, that those three people that denied him were just the people taking preliminary notes on this decision, and they weren't the final decision makers.
Right.
So maybe that is true, but still, I mean...
But I would imagine that would weigh very heavily on their decision.
They had a powerful enough... pull to deny him for a year.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, who knows? But I don't think this plan, the way they showed the plan working was cool because that all lined up. I just don't think the plan in general would have worked. The idea of having him do these fake, you know, fake sadness things would work with convincing people.
Well, the only thing that I could think of is that, you know, like I kind of talked about last week, that they wouldn't know if it were just something too personal for him to talk about and it was still too painful for him to bring up in a situation like that. And so I can see, I don't know that I would know that it would work or even would think it would work, but I could see how it potentially could work.
I'm going to say that's probably how it is in this profession, because I'm sure they have a lot of input from people that are actual lawyers and actual administrators of lawyers and judges and all that. I think they know. I think that it is probably very political. And the way you appear to sing and dance for us, little chimp on a string, that's what they wanted Jimmy to do. It's not. You were right. You're right about all that. That it's none of their business. But they want you to sing and dance. They want you to do the performance they need to see. Even if be insincere to prove your sincerity is essentially the nut of it, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Which I can't stand. But you know, that's neither here nor there.
I bet that's true to real life, though.
I don't know. I mean, I've not been in that situation, so I wouldn't have any way to know. But if it's not, it's they sure came up with a interesting story on how it could be. But Jimmy's not even happy with this. He's like going above and beyond. And this is how we know, I think, too, that this is Kim's idea. Because Jimmy wants a scenario about how they catch the judge's chambers on fire and he rushes in and saves her. Right?
Yeah.
He's thinking crazy talk. And then he just wants to go eat. He's hungry. And Kim's like, you can't eat. And he's distressed about that. So Jimmy's not thinking the same Kim, the same...
No, Jimmy's blunt-edged and Kim's ideas are very strategic and chess-like. She's thinking 3 or 4 or 5, 6 moves ahead. Jimmy's just, oh, I'm tired of this. I'm hungry.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
Jimmy wouldn't have thought to bring the refreshments in the car because he's standing in the cemetery all day. Kim had to think of, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like boorish and she's nuanced and it's just night and day the way they're playing it. Okay. So Mike finally gets a hold of the place that Ziegler's at and he finds out that he's on the property right now. So he heads there and he makes a sharp right turn and there's a car following him and he notices this. And now I am so concerned that this trick is going to be played in the parking lots. What do you think?
It probably will be by the idiots who think it's funny, like throwing the pizza on the roof.
Yes.
Probably.
Yes.
It's pretty, because, still, I'm glad they have stuff that's smart and clever and kind of funny in this show like this, though. And it's perfect. Mike uses his expertise. He doesn't go into a, you know, he doesn't get out of his car and run through a mall. He goes through a parking lot with a gate, and he knows the strategy of eluding Lalo. And that's really smart. I think that's smart writing. I also like that they make a very definitive line in the sand that Mike is just smarter than Lalo. He outsmarts him at the money place. He outsmarts him in the parking lot. And he's just a smarter adversary of the two. Mike's the smarter one. I like
that. He is. Yes, I do too. And I think they also show, or at least the way I read it, I interpret it, is that his age, he's got like these life skills in place of just the brute strength. And I like that too. But
another cool car too, Michelle, Monte Carlo. I had a Monte Carlo just like that, the one Lalo's driving. Another muscle car. I think it's like a 1970 Monte Carlo.
That's all I heard this time from Mike was about the cars and stuff. Yeah, yeah. But so we also got that great scene too from inside the mechanism of the ticket taker machine. With the gum going everywhere. I just love how they do that.
Another well-written trick, because you can't just put the gum in the machine and then Lalo's right behind you because he's just going to blast through the gate. He needs to wait and cut the guy off and put one car in between them so the dopey guy waits because his ticket won't go through the machine.
Exactly.
That was pretty well-written, too. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was like perfect. It was perfect, and it was something that Mike had to think of on the fly, and he was able to do
it. I think he thought of it because of his parking lot experience.
Sure, but I mean, this particular scenario, he had the gum, he had the wrappers, he pulled in. I mean, and he didn't know that Lalo was going to be following him, but he's just like prepared. He's like the survivor man of I don't know.
Well, once Lalo did start following him, he thought, okay, the way to put distance between me and Lalo is to get into a parking lot with a gate, put a guy between us, and then jam the mechanism so the guy between us stops for a minute, then I get away. And
sure, but I mean, this was all like in 2 minutes.
Yeah, but he knew that strategy, I think, because of his experience in the parking lot.
Sure. But Lalo gets held up because the guy can't get his... And I mean, you know, what would you do if you were that guy? That's exactly what I would have done. Wouldn't you?
Well, yeah,
I mean,
you call the thing. You push the call
button. Right, you're not going to break through it just because somebody behind you is beeping their horn. But anyway, Mike escapes him. So he does get away. And then we go to Jimmy at the HHM scholarship meeting group. And that was kind of cool how they did this scene, too. That was another one that I really enjoyed watching. They would, like, introduce somebody, and the person would say one word, and they'd cut them off and go on to the next one to show that it was person after person after person. And Jimmy's the only one who wants this one girl, this Esposito girl. And they're not even considering her, because there's several of them in there, because she's a shoplifter. And... has had some, you know, life experiences and stuff. But he says that her essay's good, and that's what got her interested in the law. And sometimes people have to learn from this kind of stuff, and she deserves another look. And Howard pretends like he's going to go along with it. Good point, Jimmy. Let's re-vote on this. Knowing good and well, they're not going to do it.
Well, Howard doesn't know that, I don't think. I think Howard admires Jimmy for making this point.
He may, but... I don't know. I mean, she didn't get it. And I think if Howard had wanted her to get it, she would have gotten it. Maybe.
Probably. But I think it was a good courtesy for Howard to do it. I also like this scene, too, because it's kind of a reflection of Jimmy's hearing. Like, they kind of thought, no matter what this guy says to us, if he doesn't show frickin' remorse about Chuck, or if he doesn't mention Chuck, he's not sincere. He's not getting past those three people. And right. That's kind of what happens here. It's like they looked at those kids and they thought, oh, these three clearly are the top. Doesn't matter what they talk about. We've decided already.
Yes. And Jimmy runs out to tell her. And that was kind of reminiscent of him waiting outside for the news of whether he would get, of what this board thought about him being reinstated. He didn't make her wait. But it was really kind of cool. And I don't know, I felt like they kind of try to trick us, because you'd think when he was walking out there that he was going to say, "You got it," but that wasn't it. And she just stands there the whole time and lets him. I think she says like four words, "I have to catch my bus" or something. And he just tells her everything, but it's, you're right. You said earlier, he's talking to himself and everything he's had to go through.
Yeah, this poor girl, man, he spills ink all over the innocent tabula rasa of this poor student. Like, you made a mistake, you'll never be free from it, so now you have to cut all corners and do all shortcuts to get to what you need, and you need to be a winner, and then look down on the people that wronged you and exact your revenge and get it, no matter what the cost.
Right. Don't play by the rules. And it goes back to that winner takes it all thing. Do whatever you have to do to be the winner, and then you show them.
So what are you thinking in the car? You don't agree that it's real emotions from Jimmy?
No, I think it's definitely real emotions for Jimmy. But that, because I thought about that scene, because otherwise it just doesn't make any sense to me. If he goes to the car and breaks down over Chuck, why would he be doing it then? It just didn't make any sense to me that anything that had happened so far, with as angry and as cold as he's been over all this stuff that Kim has set up, suddenly he just breaks down. And I think that his breakdown in the car was the break of Jimmy. I think it was the end of Jimmy from that point and the beginning of Saul. I think it was almost like the mourning of the loss of Jimmy. It was like what it took to transition, because maybe he was so put upon, maybe, and he sees other people be so put upon, and he just can't, he's just not going to take it anymore. So he just gave her this, do whatever, winner takes it all, break the rules. And then he realizes maybe that's, he's going to have to let go of the good part of him. Maybe not even consciously, but subconsciously. Because maybe, he can't catch a break otherwise.
I could also believe that grief sneaks up on people in ways that they never quite expect it. And like, you know, sometimes people are told that the person in their family has died and they just don't have any emotion. And then a week later, they kind of act like Jimmy did here.
And
a lot of people are saying, okay, this is clearly, now we have Saul Goodman. See you later, Jimmy McGill. This is the break. This is the delineation. I don't think so yet, Michelle. I think there's one more thing that has to happen, and it's probably going to happen next season early, maybe the first episode. But I don't think this is the total break into Saul Goodman.
What, with Kim, you
think? This whole episode, this season. I don't think he's broken into being Saul Goodman.
Well, right. And I don't disagree, but you said one more thing's got to happen.
Yeah, it's probably Kim.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But see, right here, I think they let us believe that he broke down over Chuck. And that's, of course, what I thought when I first saw it.
Well, I still think that.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, and that's fine. I don't, because I think if he had broken down over Chuck then I think they kind of string us along right here. They show us this with him breaking down, and then they show him pulling out Chuck's letter, and they show him talking about Chuck's letter a little bit later on to Kim and how he wants to do that. And he's quiet, and he's reserved, and Kim's looking at him like, what's wrong? What's going on with you? And he's... We're led to believe this whole time that he's, you know, remorseful, or not remorseful, that's not really it, but he's sad over Chuck being gone, and it's really affecting him. And then at the very last 90 seconds of the whole season, we find out that's not it at all. It was all just a big scam on his part. He finally did show the sincerity to everybody, including Kim, and fooled her, and it wasn't real at all. Anyway, that was my take on it.
Yeah, I think he could be. I think he could have a moment of clarity where he gets in the car, it doesn't start. It's like one more little straw of the camel on the camel's back, and it finally breaks him. And he's like, "Fuck, man, this is just too much." And it lets all those emotions out about Chuck, which are true feelings that he's actually sad about losing his brother, and it's the first expression of it. But then I think he can jump back in, like, "Okay, I gotta." Like he tells the girl, you know. Fake it till you fake it. Be strong when you're weak and then get your revenge. I think he jumps back into character. It's almost like his shield to the world. It's his armor against the world of being an open Jimmy McGill. He's Saul Goodman sometimes. I think he can jump in and out of that character.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he does not catch a break as Jimmy. The only person who catches a break is Saul. So, I don't know. I mean, you might be right, but I just really feel like that was just his defining, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm not going to be the person that I should be. I'm just not. But, I mean, you know, that was just my take on it. Okay, then we see Lalo going into Travel Wire with his gun, and he asks about Mike by his description, you know, this guy, this tall, bald, and... Fred tells him that he showed him everything he's got, and then he's, you know, Lalo isn't as suave as Mike is on getting this information out of Fred. He kind of says, okay, show me, and he's kind of grinning at him. Fred tells him to call the police, and then he turns around to take a phone call, and Lalo drops in from the ceiling, and I knew.
Yeah, just like Nacho. Oh, chicken farm? Show me. Like it's a This will be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like that's all he needs is to ask to be shown something, and he'll get all the secrets. He'll crack the safe open and get all the juicy secrets. And that's not how it works. This kid is like kind of guarded against him, and Mike is much more effective and smarter at it, socially smarter at it than Lalo is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then we see him with blood on his face, on the side of his face, and we see Fred's feet sticking out. And we see Lalo watching the security camera, and he deduces where Mike went by seeing the pamphlets that Mike has picked up. So those pamphlets were a big giveaway for everybody.
He also sees the money thing to the Werner, what's his name last
name? Right, right, Ziegler,
yeah. With the wife probably name on it. He knows everything now.
Yes, yes. But he doesn't know what they're doing. He still does not know. He doesn't know anything, because I really thought about it, and I thought, what does he actually know? And he really doesn't know anything.
Right? Yeah, I was thinking about this before we did this podcast, Michelle. What do we know? Not what do we know, but what do they know? Like, Saul doesn't know Nacho, right? Or Jimmy no. doesn't know Nacho. Mm-mm. And you're right, Lalo doesn't know... exactly what Gus is up to. He just knows of Gus and Hector, and he knows something's up, but he doesn't know quite exactly what.
Yeah, he knows Gus was having some kind of problem that he rallied his men for, but he has no idea what, and he still doesn't know.
And he doesn't know the lab and what the construction project is, and why are all these guys going out to the chicken farm, and like he's on a exploratory mission.
And it's something that doesn't even involve him in any way. This is just something he just wants to stick his nose into. This is not even anything that he would even suspect would have anything to do with the
Salamancas. Well, he doesn't want to stick his nose into it. It's his job. He's investigating the stuff on behalf of the cartel. Like, what is our northern division of the cartel doing? What's going on here? He's not just nosy. He's doing it for business reasons.
Yeah, but you think that... So you think Eladio sent him?
Yeah, somebody from Salamanca/Eladio/cartel, whatever the real headquarters of the cartel is, Lalo's figuring it out, you know?
Okay, see, I didn't get that at all. I was thinking that it was just a Salamanca family thing, and he decided to come there and make sure that the Salamanca...
Well, that's cartel.
Was taken care of.
Salamanca's
absolutely. But the Fring part of it is different. They're not really, like, the same.
Right.
So he would have no business being in Gus's business that I know of.
Well, Gus is the northern distributor of the cartel's product.
Sure, but unless you're sent there by Eladio or something, I mean, the two families you would think would just each do their own thing.
Yeah, but remember, I mean, this is probably maybe another minor little flaw, that if you were a watcher of Breaking Bad and you watch Salute, Salute keeps coming up so much in this because it's Eladio. Yeah, but Gus and his friend Max went in and proposed the artificial drug methylamine, methamphetamine, because it's artificial and you can make it. You don't have to grow it and ship it from the cocaine fields of Argentina or wherever, Colombia, wherever you get it from. So it's a much more, and it's more addictive and it's cheaper and it's, you know, you're in control of it. So Gus spilled this idea way back, or yeah, way back when he was a kid to Eladio. So Eladio knows that Gus is potentially up to something outside of the normal route of their drug business.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's way far back from what I was even thinking about in this episode. And I don't see a lot of people who watch this who would know that. You're right.
So for Lalo to think, big construction project way out in the middle of the desert, what's going on here? Why would this guy, who he knows is up to something, he's up to trickery, because he, you know, Eladio probably told him all about the meeting with Max at the pool. These guys are smart. They're cooks and they're chemists and they know how to do stuff. And they proposed to me that we make this artificial drug. Go and see what they're... I don't put it past Eladio to share this with the Salamanca family.
No, you're absolutely right.
But... And in fact, Hector was at that meeting, so he knows.
Well, Hector knew, but Hector's not talking.
Yeah, but Hector talked. That was years ago. Hector probably talked to Lalo. This is old info that I think they all know about. That okay. Gus is interested in an alternate business that could produce an artificial drug that we know as, you know, methamphetamine that became Breaking Bad. So,
well, that definitely kind of changes that with me. I still have not went back and watched Salute. I said I was going to, and I haven't. So I would probably have felt differently about that if I had. I just saw Lalo more as an annoyance, being nosy, essentially, into Gus's business just because he could. So I didn't really see it.
Yeah, but you got to take that one step back farther. Why? He's not just nosy. I'm nosy. I want to know this. Oh, that settles my nosiness. No, he wants.
Well, no, not just nosy. Not just nosy, but, you know, wanting. Look, Hector has made it very clear, and I think he would have made this clear certainly to everybody, that he wants to take over and be the big guy. He wants the Salamancas to be the ones who are putting out the money that's wrapped neatly in place of wrapped up in rubber bands and stuff like that. He wants to be the big guy. And so I just felt like it was the Salamanca way of trying to kind of infiltrate what was going on with the Fring. But, you know.
Maybe. That's certainly part of it. I think Gus has made Hector jealous, because I think Hector was the big shot Salamanca, big a number one player in the cartel team. He was the quarterback, and then Gus comes along and does things better, and Eladio's like, oh, let's do it Gus's way. It's better, it's cleaner, it's more organized, his money's not rolled up in wads, you know, his shipping methods are better, his packaging, it's he's just a better business. He's making this a better business. I think that pissed Hector off.
Absolutely.
But I think it's more than him just being nosy. I think it's strategic on his part to figure out what Gus is up to.
Yeah, I just didn't think about it being from somebody else. I thought it was just, you know, just watching it and not going back that far. It just felt like his own initiative in place of anybody else's. So, but that does make sense. Okay, then we go to Ziegler sitting out by the pool. Can you imagine how that would feel after you've been in a hole in the ground with no natural light for months to be sitting out by the pool.
Yeah, it's really stupid. It's a bad piece of writing how they make him so clownishly stupid here. He's drinking a drink with his green Crocs on, like, oh, I'm on vacation, no worries. I had to saw my way through a padlock and climb and laser light a warning camera to get here and walk 8 miles through the desert. Now I'm just going to relax at the pool.
Yep, waiting on his wife. Well, he gets a phone call, and he thinks it's his wife, but it's not. It's Lalo, because Lalo has discerned where he was. And how stupid could he be giving out that information again on the phone to somebody he's never spoken to? That was like the nail in the coffin.
Yeah, he's stupid. It's clear that he's sharing info about putting up the south wall and clearing some construction project is underway. And
if he is so stupid that he would give that kind of information to somebody on a telephone that he has never even heard of before, just for them asking, and see that he's already kind of shown he would do that because he did it in the bar with the guys and the coaster. So, I mean, but just to share that, it's just like, that had to even give Mike pause. So Mike walks up and he sees him on the phone. He takes the phone and he just kind of holds it. So
you're the dumbest smart guy I know, Ziegler.
So bad. I mean, this has to even give Mike, you know, make Mike think he's going to run his mouth. He talks too much.
Do you think Lalo had any type of eeriness about him, Michelle? Like almost an Anton Chigurh-ish way? Like he calls out Mike, not knowing it's Mike really yet. He's like, Michael? Like, yeah, how did he know it was Mike?
That's funny. Yeah, maybe. Maybe a little bit. I didn't really think about him being having like a sense in that way. But yeah, there's something really creepy about that character. There's something really creepy about people who smile at the wrong time.
Oh, no, he's gloriously sinister. Yes. Show me. Let's go have a little trek out to the desert. Like, it's all a big adventure to him, and he knows along the way people get murdered.
Gloriously sinister. I'm writing that down. I'm going to use that.
Use that in church, Michelle.
That's really... Okay, so Jimmy walks into his apartment, and this is where Kim's going over everything. She's going, okay, we'll do this and this. And this is where Jimmy's like all weird, and he just says they gave 3 bright people scholarships. He doesn't go into anything with Kim. And Kim tries to reassure him, saying all the hard stuff is done. And this is where Jimmy's saying no matter what, whether he gets back on, whether he doesn't, he's always going to be that guy.
Yeah.
And this is where he pulls out the letter that we talked about. And then we go back to Mike, and he's driven Ziegler out into the middle of nowhere. He gets out of his car. He calls Gus. He tells Gus where he was and that he was on the phone. He has to bring that up with Gus. And Gus knows who he was talking to, which was pretty cool. Gus is not easy to pull the wool over his eyes.
Yeah, this is one I missed in the who do people know and who do people not know. Mike does not know Lalo. Gus knows Lalo.
Yeah, Mike doesn't know him at all. Well, Gus didn't know him until just, a couple episodes ago.
He doesn't know him here. He tells Gus there's an interested party.
Yeah, Mike doesn't know him, but Gus didn't know him.
Gus didn't know him, yeah.
Yeah.
So Mike doesn't know Lalo. Jimmy doesn't know Lalo, but Jimmy references Lalo in that season 2, episode 8, Breaking Bad
Better
episode.
Call Saul. Mm-hmm.
So Lalo is going to get to know Jimmy somehow, and that's pretty, like, how does that connection develop?
Yeah, I don't know, but that, you're right. Yeah, that's going to be a connection. I don't know. But this is where Mike pleads with Gus about keeping Ziegler alive, and Gus is like, there's no point in having this conversation, is basically what he tells Mike. And then he says, just keep him there, evidently, because he's going to send, or obviously, because he's going to send somebody out to handle it. And Mike tells him he'll do it after Mike, because I was thinking, if you're in that situation, how far do you go, right? How much, how far would you push that? Would you have pushed it farther than Mike pushed it with Gus?
Not if you, no, because he's trying to be a soldier. He's trying to earn his way into being a good soldier with Gus. And he's smart, man. He knows, like, come on, Gus, this guy's a nice guy. He won't tell anyone. Let's give him a second, third, fourth chance.
Right.
He knows he's got to be careful for himself with Gus.
Yeah, but he didn't have to do what he did. But I think he knew that no matter what he did, the end result was going to be the same. So he could either take it and prove himself to Gus, or Ziegler's going to be just as dead, and Mike's going to look weaker, maybe.
Yeah, and Mike helped him save his wife.
He did.
Gus would not have made that part of the plan. Gus would have let the wife get there, then they both get taken out to the desert, and whatever happens to both of them, not just to Werner.
Right, and he, and it's sad. It was sad because Ziegler had to get on the phone. He had to practically just like, I hated that. He had to tell his wife that he didn't want to see her because she wasn't going to turn around. And he told her that. He told her, at first he said something happened at the lab. He had to go back, or something happened at work. He had to go back. And she was like, not going to do that. And he started yelling at her to shut up, that he didn't want to see her anyway. And knowing that's going to be the last thing he ever says to her. And then, though, he makes it easy as he can on Mike. Knowing, even knowing all that, oh, look at the stars. And, I mean, you would have to think, I mean, he's missed looking at the stars. He's seen nothing except artificial light in months. And he said, I'm just going to walk out there and look at them.
Yeah, this scene was another direct correlation of Werner and Walter. Because let me speak to Frank, like when Walt was finally caught and they were going to kill him, and they ended up getting on the phone with Jesse to tell him to kill Gale. Let me speak to Frank one more time. You know, I won't take any money. You know, just let me finish the lab. Let me finish working. You can keep all the money. He's begging, like Werner here.
Yes.
And the same thing with Walt, you know. It worked for Walt because he was smarter than Werner, but.
Yeah, I didn't put that together, but I can see some similarities in that now. But Mike assures him that his wife will be okay. Werner wants him to swear it, and he does. And he says that there'll be German attorneys brought in, and a story will be told to her, and she'll believe it. And because Werner's worried if she just doesn't hear from him that she'll come searching for him and then get killed anyway. And Mike works all that out.
So what would you do, Michelle, if you're the wife and you get this call? You're already at the airport of another country, and your husband gives you this call. What do you do?
I mean, I guess you'd have to go home. I think I'd go home. I think if I heard some kind of panic in his voice and he told me to go home, I'd trust him. Been married to him a bunch of years. I'd trust him.
You don't think that Werner told his wife in those phone calls, okay, I'm not supposed to be doing this, but I'm going to sneak away and you're going to meet me at the Albuquerque Hot Springs. You don't think that she knew that he was sneaking this, or do you think it was all just a vacation?
No, I think it had to have been some kind of sneaking, right? Because they didn't talk about it above board. They didn't just go,
well, that's
oh,
what
yeah,
I'm getting
what
at. So if it's a
meet?
Sneaky plan and then it goes south, you don't think she's worried? Like, wait a minute, this is weird that he's going south now.
Yeah, absolutely.
So but, you just go back, you just give up on it and go back home?
I mean, what choice would you have?
Call the police, go to the hotel anyway, send the police to the hotel or the resort, wherever he was with his Crocs. I don't know. I think, I don't know if I would have done what she did, but I don't know what a wife does.
Yeah, well, we don't even really know what she did yet. And that's you make a great point. I don't know. I really hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought of the fact that it had to have been a sneaky thing anyway. But you know, and her thinking, okay, he snuck away from this, and now, you know, he couldn't wait to see me, and now suddenly he's telling me he doesn't want to see me. I don't know. That's a good question, though. But Mike shoots, and we see the two figures, the shadows, and one shoots the other one, and one falls.
Yeah, that was a beautiful scene, photographic, panoramic scene. So they explained how they did that on the Insider podcast. They did it really up close, and then they decided it didn't look as good. So they cut that scene, and they made a CGI version of the night sky all around it, and they made them appear small, and they put the desert and the sky and stuff in the background, and they made it look really cool like it did.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Also, that chicken ranch is totally gone, Michelle. It was being torn down while they were actually filming it back in Breaking Bad. And that was all CGI, too, because that chicken ranch is not there anymore in real life.
Really? That's interesting. I'm going to have to listen to that podcast. I did not know that. Okay, then Gus had Gene in the super lab. You got to explain that one to me. I don't understand that
Gus
at all.
Gus had Gail in the super
Gail. Lab. Gail. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's another thing that, I mean, in my timeline, Gus has Walt. Walt goes bad on him, so he gets Gail. Or Gus appears to be sick, so he's got to get Gail. But that's not the timeline. Gus had Gail, then he got Walt, and then he got Gail back. Gail was first in the lab, in the plan of the lab.
In the plan, yeah, at least. I don't think the lab had ever been used when Walt and Jesse used it. Right.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. And I don't know why he's got him there now. What was the point of that? It's not even halfway done.
Well, the other thing they said in the Insider podcast is they filmed this episode, and it got to, like, you know, almost like our podcast here, Michelle. We're going way long on this, especially with our music video thing. So we got to kind of speed it up. But they said this was way over, and it even ended up being like an hour-long episode, even with all the cuts. So they had to edit this way down at the last minute. And I think they might have hacked the scale scene up pretty bad, because there is really no reason for him to be in this episode at all. It didn't reveal anything.
Well, right. And they don't show Gus suffering fools. And he deals with Gail, who's just always wanting to jump the gun. And they've shown us that, you know, whether they meant to show us that in this part or not, they did. And they've shown us that before with him. When he went to see him, he's just always... I mean, you know, I haven't told you, Mike, but we got a puppy. We got a puppy. It adopted us, and it's this little stray. And it is just, like, so excited for everything, right? He's, like, 5 months old. And I completely lost my train of thought thinking about my little puppy.
Why Gail in the lab, and why Gail was there before Walt, and why Gail is... quick to jump into stuff.
Yes, Gail's like a puppy. He's like this puppy. I mean, you mention something and he just jumps and doesn't think and does this crazy stuff, right? I mean, and he should know better.
Well, he's innocent like a puppy, too.
He is. He is.
All I thought about with this lab is that when I first saw the lab, I thought of it way differently than I think of it now. Because when I first thought of the lab, when Walt first got shown the lab, I thought, wow, this shining diamond technology is glistening, gleaming, or maybe ruby is better for all the frickin' blood that's been spilled there. Mm. And we know of, like, Victor and Gail and that fly.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but now
fly.
Verner's connected to this thing. This is like a hell. And maybe that's why it's red. It's like it's satanic.
It really is, and it's like nothing good. Well, I mean, yeah, I don't think they ever pretended like anything good was coming out of it. But even for the people associated there, it was just like this pit.
But when we first saw it, it was this gleaming, like, wow, now Walt's going to have this job. He's going to get, not just going to get $1.4 million, he's going to get like $12 million. He's going to be able to split it with Jesse, and they're each going to get $6 million in this gleaming technology lab. But it's way more evil than that.
Well, yeah, and it was also, you know, hidden so well and ventilated. They made the point about the ventilation so well. And we have to remember that they were cooking out of an RV in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, so it was almost like, that's what I mean. It's like a salvation, a big step up to, it's a good thing
right
in their story, but it's got history.
Okay, I just had no idea why they showed Gale. And we see Mike come in, and Gale is leaving because he realized he's messed up with Gus. He's overshot, you know, what Gus wanted from him again. And Mike just nods at Gus to let him know, I guess, that everything's done with Werner, and that's that. And then we go to Jimmy and Kim walking into the bar hearing, and Jimmy breaks out the letter, and he starts to read the letter, and then he stops in the middle of it, and he goes into this whole big, long thing. He stands there and says that he doesn't have a prepared statement, but he starts to read the letter, and then he talks about how the letter's personal, and it's such a good letter, and just all this stuff, and everybody's crying. The people are crying on the board. Kim's crying. Kim is suckered into this. And, you know, the reason he became a lawyer is because he wanted to make Chuck proud. And then he goes into the whole, Chuck wasn't an easy guy to make proud. If you made him proud, you knew. And then he says that Chuck didn't suffer fools. And Jimmy was, or Chuck was always right. And Jimmy says that usually he actually was right, and that Jimmy could never live up to his standards. He was never as smart, as moral, as respected, or as good as Chuck. But he said, I'm going to try whether you give me my license back or not. I'm going to try. And everybody's like crying over this. And they walk out, and Kim is so happy, and they realize that Jimmy's going to get his license back. And then she realizes that it was just a shtick to Jimmy. He goes, can you believe I did that? Can you believe I thought to say that? I've got this good letter. And he's like going on like that. And she is shocked.
Victor, yeah, she's one of the suckers.
She is. So Victor has conned Gazelle or Giselle.
So
or
why? Whatever. So, okay, so Kim's in on this all the way through this, and now she's shocked that Jimmy could, how could my man Jimmy do this? She's part of this, though. She can't be this shocked. That's a mistake.
Oh, I don't think so. Oh, Mike, no. Let me tell you something about how, you know, I mean, like, women can sometimes, men, I'm sure, too, maybe, but just because he can do it to somebody else doesn't mean he can do it to her. He can't fool her. She's part of this. This is oh, I completely buy.
So what's surprising to her?
That she was schnookered by him. She's shocked that she wasn't in on his plan and that she didn't know. It's just like I said, Victor schnookered Giselle. How do you say that?
Yeah, Giselle. I still don't buy it that they're in on this plot, this illegal plot. She's keeping him nourished while he fools people at a gravestone. And she thinks, wow, this guy, you know, I'm going to help him do this. And then he does this, and she's upset.
She doesn't think he'd do it to her. She doesn't think he would do it to her. He's a bad guy to other people, but not me. He's good to me. He wouldn't do this to me.
And but what did he do to her? He didn't.
He schnookered her. He conned her. And she didn't think he could or would. And this takes me all the way back to his breakdown. Because I think the breakdown was the, you know, not that we won't see pieces of him again, but the goodbye to Jimmy.
But how did he con her? She was fooled. She misread his speech in the courtroom, clearly. She misread it, but it wasn't like him misleading her. The plan was to read the letter and then convince everybody, okay, Jimmy did care about Chuck. You get your license back. He switches halfway through because he kind of quarterback calls it that This isn't working as well as I thought. She didn't know about that. I agree to that. But he didn't do anything to fool her. She just misread it.
No, he didn't do anything deliberately against her, but he's been quiet around her, and they showed us that, and not real forthcoming. He didn't talk about the girl who didn't get the scholarship that he rooted for, and then he gets up there, and he changes, and he conned her. Whether he even meant to con her or not, she realized, I think, that she could be a victim to his con. And even, I mean, she's sitting there crying by what he's saying.
Yeah, I see it differently. I don't see it as conning her. I think it's her misinterpreting what she thought was real emotion. They all did, including us watching it, thought it was real emotion.
How is that not a con?
Because he's intentionally fooling them, not her.
It doesn't matter who you're trying to fool. If you fool other people, you're conning them,
right? But she knew the nuts and bolts of this plan all along. The fool, the cemetery thing, the reading room, she knew it was all a plot.
Yeah, but then
they didn't.
Right, you're right. But then she thought that he had like this moment of clarity and this moment of sincerity. And it wasn't that at all. You could see the look on her face.
I say that's on her. I think you're right about that. But I say that's on her, not on Jimmy. That's her reading it one way that it is not. That's not on Jimmy trying to be deceptive to her.
Well, maybe not. Maybe not. No, I'm not saying necessarily he was doing anything to her. I don't think he was. But tell me why he walked away from her like that in this. Something felt off about that as well.
Yeah,
the woman
maybe
comes out,
I mean,
and she
that,
says there's
that
good
is,
news.
That does seem transitional. That I said that we're not all the way to Saul Goodman yet, and it appears that that's a pretty good, damn good step to Saul Goodmanism. But you know, I think a part of a con is like intentionally misleading somebody, and Jimmy's not doing that to Kim. He's being persuasive, and she bought into it like we all did. But that's not a con. A con is something different. That's her seeing a new side of him that she didn't know before. And maybe the word con just doesn't fit for me because of that.
Maybe, but maybe she realized how bad he can be.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, how convincing. And
it's
how
a new side of him that she is now made aware of for sure. But I don't think that's a con. I just think that's her saying, whoa, wait a minute. I never really knew this about you. That's very true.
And then he's already made up his mind, and he didn't share that with her either, to change his name. He did mention about, you know, his name to her, but he's doing it. He needs the form. He's going to practice under, it's all good, man.
So that's the one thing that makes me think he's not quite there yet, is he doesn't say it right. He doesn't say it correctly. He says, Saul Goodman, not Saul Goodman.
Maybe.
He says it the way you would say it if you're trying to maybe figure it out for the first time.
Maybe.
So.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see next season. And I mean, I am excited for it. I haven't lost my enthusiasm for the show. I hate Jimmy going away.
All right, well, we'll probably see some more of them.
Yeah, hopefully.
All right, Michelle, well, that's the end of season 4 of Better Call Saul.
Whole season.
Thanks for doing it with me. It was pretty fun to get through this season 4, 10-episode project with you.
Yeah, thank you. It really was. I appreciate it.
And we're going to do our little preview of our YouTube video discussion. So if that's all you care about for Better Call Saul, that's it for 410.
That's it.
Winner and the season 4 of Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
So, Michelle, on this YouTube project, why would I pick a video? Why would I pick a song? We've all kind of both said that people don't know this, but we kind of like the 80s. I think the 80s are my favorite decade of music.
Definitely.
So
yeah.
Why would I pick a song from the 90s that only has two lines in it to be the first song?
And
what do you think?
I couldn't tell you, and you picked a song, a YouTube video that has no video. It was just like the picture.
Yeah, there's a video. There's an official video in that I'll put it, a link to it in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah. Good. And it's a song from 92, and it sounds like it's from 1974 to me.
Yeah. It's got that Aretha Franklin-y diva. That's partially why I did it. But the reason I picked a simple poppy song with no deep thoughts is this was at a time, this was like 3 or 4 weeks ago when we were late that week also on our podcast because so much going on. And I thought, well, we're running out of time to have a time to introduce this. So let's just do a simple little song that's easy to talk about. It sounds kind of good and people can get a quick little blurb, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. But the more I put into this to investigate it, the more interesting it became. And it's hard to summarize this in 2 or 3 minutes. But that's why I picked kind of a dance song from the 90s and not some in-depth, deep thinker song that would have come up with from the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, it's this electronic kind of music song. It was different than, because, you know, we've talked about before how we have podcasts for many more years than 5 years. We've podcast because we've talked about songs and TV shows and stuff like that for many more years than that. So,
yeah, that part didn't make it into our podcast. She said, right. Well, this is our 5-year anniversary, or the other day was, or something. Because our first podcast was about the song Wendy, which was kind of the song that was related to Breaking Bad for Wendy the hooker.
Right. Right. And that was October 8th of 13 is the first time that went up. So, but most of the songs that we've talked about over the years have not been songs like this. So, and you haven't even called the name of the song, I don't think, yet. So you might want to go into that. But it is bizarre that. So,
So the song is called I'm Gonna Get You, and it's by the pop music. It's almost like a girl talky type. There's a DJ called, it's a DJ like electronica dance music song, and it's called I'm Gonna Get You. It's by a band called Bizarre Inc. And Bizarre Inc. was an electronica group, house techno music group from like they were formed in 1989. I think this song came out in 1992 or 93.
Yeah.
And
92.
It was two DJs that started the band, so they just sampled music and they made music and. They did samples of stuff. They weren't like accomplished guitarists or studio musicians or anything. And the way this song came about was they liked another vocalist. It's Bizarre Inc. and Angie Brown is the singer on Bizarre Inc. And the way Angie Brown got connected to Bizarre Inc. is that the guys in Bizarre Inc. liked another singer called Jocelyn Brown, who I think is not related to Angie Brown.
Not related, right. Mm-hmm.
But they used Angie because they liked the Jocelyn Brown song, but they didn't want to license the original track. They couldn't afford to do it. So they had Angie Brown just re-sing it. And she did it in like the first take. She knocked it out in like 20 minutes, and she had this song with her vocals that just took on the first take.
And then right.
3 months later, it was a hit.
And nobody expected that. They didn't expect anything like that. And it really, the song, yeah, like you said, it was a massive hit.
Yeah. So I like, you know, I like this whole idea of doing these YouTube videos of songs is because of the social comments, the way these videos make people feel and remember music that when they were younger and they were single and dancing and, you know, it's just stuff that like that makes you go back and think about things and what you think now when you think back about them.
Sure.
And I also, another thing I liked was the, like I said, the karaoke hero part of it. And I think Angie Brown is a bit of a karaoke hero here. She comes in and she takes her shot, her one shot, and she makes it, she nails it in 20 minutes. And the song becomes like number 2 on the British pop charts. And just really a cool story behind it.
So did you know the song in 92? Do you remember it?
I remembered it when I heard it again recently, but I didn't think, oh, I want to go back and get that Bizarre Inc. song. I just heard it, and I thought this would be a good part of the thread for the whatever we call it. We don't even know what we're going to call this channel yet or how we're going to do it, but whatever right. We call this project, part of West Coast Project, but I just thought this would be a good way to introduce it.
Yeah, I agree.
So, She did another interesting thing about Angie Brown is she did the song a couple years ago on The Voice, on the UK's The Voice, The Voice UK.
Right.
And she got rejected. She didn't get selected. So she did it, what is that? If you do the math, 92, 8, and 14, 22 years later, and she got snubbed by The Voice UK.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, so, and it sounds okay on there. I mean, it's not as good as the recorded digital electronica dance version that you hear when you hear the YouTube version of, you know, the perfect studio version. But it still sounded pretty good. I mean, I would have passed her through that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't ever watch those shows or anything, but hearing, I went back and listened to some of the, well, a little tiny bit of Jocelyn Brown and her voice. And Angie Brown, to my knowledge right now, she was trying to mimic the Jocelyn Brown way. Is that why they got her on
this? Yeah, that's what I said, karaoke hero. She's Ernie singing, you know, Total Eclipse of the Heart. She's just way better at it. She probably admired Jocelyn Brown as a super, since Jocelyn Brown was his big star. I think probably Angie Brown became a bigger star than Jocelyn Brown because of this project, though, with Bizarre Inc. But I think she was a singer, and she admired another singer, Jocelyn Brown, and got the chance to sing her song, and she nailed it.
Right.
But the real cool part about all this, Michelle, is the YouTube comments, like kind of the point of our project here.
Right.
And the one that most stands out, we're really running out of time here because this is a long podcast with our breaking, with our solve before it. But
right.
The one comment I really noticed most of all of them was somebody said, I didn't get up and walk to the dance floor when this came on. I ran to the dance floor back in 1992 when this came on. And that's like the best description of it. It's like, it's a song you hear where you just have to get up and dance to it.
It is a really, it definitely has that sound, that techno kind of dance sound to it. That was never really my thing. That wasn't my favorite kind of music or anything, but going into any kind of club or anything back then, it was like different renditions of that same kind of music. But yeah, Mike, you're right. The songs, they don't just make me think about things. They don't just take me back. They make me feel things that I felt back then. And it's a really interesting sensation to do that, particularly as I get older and you hear some of this music, and it really creates the feeling that I had when I heard it way back when, or whatever was going on in my life. And some songs are really sad, and then some songs are really uplifting, and it's just the feeling that it creates. So that's great, that comment about you didn't walk to the dance floor, you ran to the dance floor.
So there's another reason I picked this one, Michelle, for our first one, and it's because you have daughters and all this. But did you find the girl in the other video that I told you about or showed you?
No, I did not.
So there's another video of Angie Brown singing this, and it's got like 290 views. It's like nobody's looking at this video. She's singing this song, I'm Gonna Get You, at a picnic somewhere in the UK. I think it's at Coventry University or something. Nobody's there, maybe 75 people. It's a hidden gem of a video. It's like the Stevie Nicks hairdresser video.
Oh, wow.
Which is one we should definitely show
definitely.
In this podcast.
Yeah.
But this Angie Brown video is also a hidden gem, and it's in plain sight if people would only look at it. It's like a 300-view video. She's dancing with these young girls, and the video's crappy. It's a handheld cell phone, and the audio is awful, and it's outside. But the content is just joyous of Angie. She's sweating up a storm. It's like in the summer somewhere in the UK. And the crowd is older, probably the club dancers from 1993, drinking beer on some Sunday afternoon in, you know, 2014.
Yeah.
So they're all older. But the young girls are amazing to me. They represent... They represent the reason we all love music. You know, it's the universal language of joy and base communication we all have. We all understand it, not knowing even why sometimes. But in this video, there's this one girl, and she's super shy and insecure, and she's looking around, and she watches other people who are dancing to see how she should dance. you know, how when you're at something like you're not sure if you should dance and
sure,
she's
yeah.
shy about it. And so mm-hmm. she kind of looks around and she doesn't want to take a step out of place. And she, this Angie Brown gets her to come out and do this joyful dance. And it's like an ascension watching this girl. So I don't know. It kind of made me think of you as a mother, and maybe it'll help you remember your kids when they were 14-year-old daughters and how they're
oh, that's cool.
They're
Thank
really
you.
Beautiful with their potential, but they're just too shy to find the expression for it. But then they
yeah, but
ultimately
part of
they
that,
do.
Yeah, part of the, I mean, that's part of the beauty of it, right? Is coming into your own and experiencing that and learning that. I don't know. That's really cool. I now want to see that. No, I looked for her and I couldn't find her. Mike had messaged me a picture of a girl and said, see, you know, if you can find, but I mean, I couldn't, I didn't see it at all. So
yeah, I'll put a link to the YouTube video of the studio version of the I'm Gonna Get You. And then this video of this Coventry College, Angie Brown just singing.
That's
with the
really
girls.
Cool.
I hope that girl, I mean, it's just beautiful when she finds her way through this. And I hope that girl is mayor of some town somewhere in England, or a leader of some sort, helping other young girls just realizing their potential, you know, because you could just see her growing. She grows up like a fraction, a tiny little growth spurt in this video.
That's interesting.
And the final thing, and on the video I did send you, it has kind of the thing, there's a lot of that Jocelyn Brown, that song was sampled a million times. So if you listen to other cuts from the 90s songs, dance, electronica, dance songs, you can hear that song that she did that I resampled in other songs. So it's kind of the base DNA of like a lot of electronica from the 90s. But also the Apple EarPods commercial. When Apple first came out with their iPhone and their iPods, and they showed the earphones, remember that used to be the silhouette of somebody dancing with,
yeah, uh-huh.
It was like black on white with, or white on black with just like the silhouette.
Right.
That's the cover of that YouTube of the one version that I sent you.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
yeah.
They kind of stole that idea from the Bizarre Inc., whoever did the graphics for that album.
That's anyway. Interesting. Yeah, that's good. And also, I'm sure that you probably saw it too, but that Voice UK, it was also noted on there that the song, okay, first of all, they said that it brought the audience to their feet, a lot of them, and still it wasn't, you know, whatever they do, recognized or whatever, they didn't buy it or whatever.
She didn't move on to the next level, yeah.
Right. But they also said that that song had inspired part of the Black Eyed Peas track, the Boom Boom Pow track of the Black Eyed Peas. So I thought that was kind of interesting, too, that the song, not only because you're right, you can hear the techno dance stuff. You can hear that in so much of the techno dance stuff. I mean, I don't have a specific ear for that kind of stuff, but to my very inexperienced ear for that, you can hear it. But also to know that it even has affected music much later.
Yeah, in a way, all music does, right? It's if it's good music or if it's interesting music to somebody, they kind of sample it or copy it, even if it's not directly. It's part of what they create when they desire to become a musician and, you know, work for hours to practice something and get good at it. It's because they loved something before them.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, Michelle, this is a long one. So how do people reach you in the long off season? Hopefully, if you want to listen to some of this YouTube commentary on audio and video stuff, we can continue. But what's your Twitter?
I am at Michelle from TN.
All right. And I'm at Scathing Tweet. So that's going to be the best way to figure out how we're going to do this, because we'll post it. I'll tweet it. But until then, we'll see you next season on Better Call Saul.
Okay, we'll see you later, Mike.
All right, thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Mike.
da 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 da